What a wonderful omen under which to begin the west line! Mason, raising his tankard with an abruptness advisable only in rooms where one's face is known. At the very moment he was elevated, I lay flat upon a back that, for all I knew, was broken in a desert place in New Jersey. We're cursed, you knew the... Dixon tries to bear down and attend closely. And none could have foreseen. Oh, Maskline knew that Bradley was ill. Mason attempting to be chirpy is less easy to bear than Mason in blackest melancholy. Everyone knew it, as everyone knew that Bliss would come on only as caretaker, for he as well was old and ailing, yet there should be time enough left him for each aspirant to make his interest as he might. Why, I, and yet you always knew he cultivated. Cultivated? Pooh! Maskline caressed and slithered, insinuating himself into an old man's esteem. For having done nothing, really, one more lad from Cambridge, clever with numbers, though none beyond that damn tripos riddling, who but happens to be Clive of fucking India's fucking brother-in-law. Ah, Dixon, this seventh wrangler, this bilious, windy hypnotic in the herbal of human character, this mean-spirited intriguer, his usage of poor Mr. Harrison and his chronometer, how contemptible! Few are his ideas. Lunarian is his one faith. To plod is his entire project. He will never make any discovery on the order of aberration nor nutation. He is unworthy, damn him, to succeed James Bradley. His face is wet, more with spittle than tears. Hey, Mason. Dixon by now has learned to stay at a respectful distance and not to rely too heavily upon touch as a way of communicating. You believed, really? Oh, well, really. It's like a woman, isn't it? You look at each other, you think, of course not, she thinks, of course not. Yet the alternatives hang about, don't they, like wraiths? City matters. Would I know anything about that? I was up there 4 years. I lost two women I loved. God help me. I lost Bradley, dear to me as well. Were tears sixpences, I'd have more invested in that miserable hilltop than Maskline could borrow. Be the co-signer Clive himself. Well, let him never sleep. Let him pace those rooms, one after another, in the idle silence of the afternoons, till he hears the voices telling him he has no right there, and to go away. Let him stand at last in the octagon room and shiver in the height of summer. Let him fear to stay up for stars that culminate too late. Mason, aren't Maskline and Morton both Cambridge men? Wasn't it Morton who put his name forward? They must have wanted one of their own. The last three ARs were all Oxford men. There's a difference? Mason stares, then says slowly, Yes, Dixon, there is a difference. And he went in as a bloody sizer. I could have done that. Don't you think I was one of their own? What then, the bastard son, the faithful old drudge in the background? Haven't I any standing in this? Is that what this fucking exile in America's about, then, Morton and his fucking Royal Society, to get me out of the way so that Maskline can go prancing up to Greenwich freed of opposition? So I'm dragged along in the wake of your ill fortune, another bonny mess. I teach you to take care whom your name gets attached to. Ruin. He pulls his hat over his eyes and begins to pound his head slowly upon the table. According to this, Dixon soothingly, as if 'twere a fan, waving a page enclosed with the letter clipped from the Gentleman's Magazine of the December previous, there were, it seems, 10 competing for the job. Betts, Beavis, Short, so on. Any of those names light a match? Though reaching the outskirts of forbearance, can he really continue? Yes, he ought to. Either Mason cannot admit there's a class problem here, or even this deeply compromised, he may yet somehow keep faith that in the service of the heavens, dramatic elevations of earthly position are to be expected of these times, this reign of reason, by any reasonable man. Very well. Mason, you are a miller's son. That can never satisfy them. What of it? Mason snaps back. Flamsteed was a maltster's son. Halley was a soap boiler's son. Astronomers Royal are supposed to be social upstarts, for mercy's sake. And I'd friends in the company. Inflecting this, however, with a snort and a sidewise tilt of the head, assuming Dixon knows roughly how Sam Peach and Clive of India might sort out upon the company's own chain of being. Did you and Maskline talk about any of this when you were together at St. Helena? Are you insane? Oh, off and on, and thee? Bradley's name may have come up. And Maskelyne, may I speculate, said, has he given thought to a successor? Why, that's amazing. You might have been there. What is it about you people? Some mystical gift, I imagine. And he didn't say, Mason, though clearly I would welcome your support, I'm going to have this AR job with or without it. Anything like that? Why are you trying to get me to relive this? It was unpleasant enough the first time. So as to avoid it myself, of course. I shall get through this, Dixon. Were I thee, I should make him feel guilty every chance I got. Perhaps he doubts his own worthiness. Thou must never make it too obvious, of course, always the dignified sufferer. Yet there is no predicting what advantage thou may build upon his uncertainty. Why, bless me, sir, you are a Jesuit after all. Sinister Alfonso, move aside. Sheathe that stiletto, wicked Giuseppe. Here is the true Italian art. I, oh, why, I am simple as a pony, sir. Born in a drift, a corf for my cradle, and naught but the back shift for schoolmasters there. Chapter 44. Now, many is the philosophical mind, including my own, convinced that rapid motion through the air is possible along and above certain invisible straight lines, crossing the earthly landscape, particularly in Britain, where they are known as ley lines. Any number of devout enthusiasts, annual Stonehenge and Avebury pilgrims, quacks, mongers, Bedlamites, each has his tale of real flights over the countryside above these ley lines. Withal, 'tis possible to transfer from one of them to another, and thus in theory travel to the furthest reaches of the kingdom, without once touching the earth. Something is there that permits it. No one knows what it is, though thousands speculate. Here went we off upon the most prodigious such line yet attempted. In America, where undertakings of its scale are possible, astronomically precise, carefully set prisms of oolite, the master valve of rose quartz at the eastern terminus. Any argument from design here must include a yearning for flight, perhaps even higher and faster than is customary along ley lines we know. I try not to wonder. I must wonder. Whenever the surveyors separate, they run into thickets, bogs, bad dreams. United, they pursue a ride through the air. They are linked to the stars, to that inhuman precision, and are deferred to because of it, though also feared and resented. Wick's Cherry Coke, Spiritual Daybook. March is snowy and frozen. Clear nights are rare, and the surveyors need every one they can get for azimuth observations to find out the exact direction westward to strike off in. Everything upon the ground by April, as they're about to begin the west line, must be sighted through a haze of green resurrection. There'll be more out there than stars to gaze at, says Mr. Harland, who's hired on as an instrument bearer at 5 shillings a day. Over Susquehanna, once you've crossed the York to Baltimore Road, you'll see. I grew up west of that road, adds Mrs. Harland, and he ain't just humming Love in a Cottage, either. 'Tis not for everybody. I know I lit east as soon as I was tall enough to cry in the right uncle's ale can, and it's also how I met the Wild Ranger here, who's never been west of Elk Creek. Maybe it's not even for you, Johnny. Though we do understand your sentiments, ma'am, Mason advises, we are legally restrained from intervening in anyone's family business. Ah, well, too bad. Tried my best. Fate is fate. Lord'll provide, she carols, bustling back into the house. Took it awfully well, I thought, says Mason. Maybe not, John Harland shaking his head as he follows her in. Better go see. She never actually said she wanted him off the crew, Dixon notes. It's what she meant. You have to understand them, Dixon. They've this silent language that only men of experience speak at all fluently. Then why is it I've lost count of how many of my evenings I've ruined with thy talk of cannibalism or suicide or bickering among the Whigs? Anything but what they wish to hear. Unannounced blow. Robert Boggs comes running by with 50 weight of harness hanging from each shoulder. Some stranger over there by the monument acting peculiar. Off he runs again. They go to sea, and there he is, up in the corner of Harlan's Field, curiously prostrated before the chunk of rose quartz where cross the latitude of the south edge of Philadelphia and the longitude of the postmarked west. The single point to which all work upon the west line and its eastward protraction to the Delaware shore will finally refer. All about, in the noontide, go wagoners and instrument-bearers in commotion, preparing for the translation south to Mr. Bryant's field and the post marked west. Swifts come out in raiding parties, but avoid the luminous stone. Dogs wait at what they've learned is a safe distance from it. Quite powerful, when they have coaxed him back at last to their own regime of light, where'd you boys find this one? Ooh-wee! He has been trying to find what in his calling is known as the ghost, another crystal inside the ostensible one, more or less clearly formed. 'Tis there the pictures appear, though it varies from one operator to the next. Some need a perfect deep blank and cannot scry in ghost quartz. Others, before too much clarity, become blind to the other world. My own crystal. He searches his pockets and produces a hand-sized specimen with a faint violet tinge. The symmetries are not always easy to see. Here, these twin heptagons, centering your vision upon their common side, gaze straight in. Ah! Mason recoiling and nearly casting away the crystal. Huge dark eyes, the scryer wishes to know. Aye, who is it? Mason knows. The face I see is a bit more friendly, but then 'twould have to be, wouldn't it, or I'd be in some other line of work. His name is Jonas Everybeat, and in the time he travels with the party, he will locate, here and there across the land, islands in Earth's magnetic field, anomalies with no explanation for being where they are, other than conscious intervention by whoever or whatever was here before the Indians. Anybody's guess what they're for, and then your own projected row of oolite shafts, perfectly lined up with the spin of the Earth. Suggestive, anyhow. Of what? Think of Mr. Franklin's harmonica. Rather than a finger circling upon the stationary rim of a glass, the finger keeps still, whilst the rim rotates. As long as there is movement between the two, a note is produced. Similarly, this oolite array at this latitude will be spun along at more than 700 miles per hour, spun through the light of the sun and whatever medium bears it to us. What arises from this? What music? Everyone has a point of view they wish to persuade the surveyors to. Sometimes you're the slate, Mason observes. Sometimes you're the chalk. Eh, Dixon frowns. And here again is that bothersome crimp, O'Rooty. The body jobber offering them his services can arrange, he declares, for any workforce, at any level of skill, anywhere you want, when you want them. For instance, I imagine you'll be needing some axemen. Hey, do I know this business? First thing to decide is how much you want to spend. Local lads at 3 and 6 per diem, or for what prices out to but a few farthings more, picks up a couple of powder horns, places them either side of his head. Scandinavians, yes, the famous Swedish loggers, each the equal of any 10 axemen these colonies may produce. Finest double-bit axes, part of the package, lifetime warranty on the heads, 72-hour replacement policy, customized handle for each axeman, for Bjorn may not swing like Stig, nor Stig like Sven, as the famous Timothy Tox might say. Swedish steel here, secret processes guarded for years, death to reveal them, take you down a perfect swathe of forest, trimmed and cleared, fast as you're likely to chain the distance. Parts of a single great machine, human muscle and stamina, become but adjunct to the deeper realities of steel that never needs sharpening, never rusts. Oh, come, sir, the surveyors exclaim together. So then, take but one. Take Stig here, on a trial basis only. Pay what you think he's worth. If you don't like him, send him back. Next in line behind O'Rooty comes a developer or projector of land schemes. Kill him, advises Dixon, before anyone can get in a word. Mason risks a quick lateral squint, but can neither see nor smell any sign of intoxication. And do it sooner rather than later, as it only gets more difficult with time. Since early in their acquaintance, the two have learned to mutter together so as to remain unheard beyond a pipe stem's length. The projector, devotedly binocular and far too brisk, moves in an industrious hop from one foot to the other, back and forth. This is someone you know? Mason not yet all that alarmed. In general only, but worked for enough of them, didn't I? Not proud of myself for it, needed the money. So abridged is this reply that Mason surmises some long and probably tangled Iliad of woe back among the friths and fells, which did not work out in favor of Dixon, who continues, "Well, then, what's thy preference?" "Eh, what?" "As to which of us will do the deed?" "Deed?" "You know," cocking a rigid finger toward their visitor, who at last grows aware of being under discussion. "Dixon, come back to the tent for a moment, would you?" "Yes, yes, there's a good chap. Just a word. Excuse us, please. Small technical question. Quite trivial, really. Come along. Good. There we go." Mason, having visited Bedlam as well as Tyburn in a profound mime of calm and patience, Dixon playing his part with equal vigor, using as his models any number of lunatics to be found in Bishop any market day. The first day of the West Line, April 5th, falls upon a Friday, the least auspicious day of the week to begin any enterprise, such as sailing from Spithead, for example. To stand at the postmarked west and turn to face west can be a trial for those sentimentally inclined, as well as for everyone nearby. It is possible to feel the combined force, in perfect enfilade, of every future second unelapsed, every chain yet to be stretched, every unknown event to be undergone, the unmodified terror of keeping one's latitude. They have been held up by the weather, first snow, which by the fourth day, even undrifted, has reached a depth of 2 feet and 9 inches, then clouded skies, which prolong the impossibility of zenith observations. Thursday night, the 4th, the sky is finally clear enough for them to determine their latitude exactly. The next day, the weather holding, they decide not to waste the Friday, but to seize it, bad luck and all. A few wrinkles to be smoothed. Monsieur Darby and Cope have left till the last minute the question of who's to go before and who behind upon the chain. The phrases good enough and more or less must be discouraged from the outset. Rules of precedence for Dixon's circumferenter have to be worked out, principally that, in case of conflict, it must ever defer to the sector. Astronomy before magnetism. At last, Mr. Cope pulls up his bob and gathers and stows his plumb line, thus removing his end of the chain from the postmarked west, proceeding then in that direction, across the snowy field, to Mr. Darby's former station. Detachment. The beginning of the west. So they set off, the chain a jingle, wagons a rumble, farm geese a blare, heading into farmland with a quiet roll to it, watched by deer and kine, under the usual injunctions against trampling garden patches or molesting orchards, the instruments, with a tent of their own, stranger than anything the party expects to see between here and Little Christiana, which isn't much anyway, owing to the trees, for which 11 more axemen hire on the second week. You'd think these instruments were alive. Matthew Marine grumbles, riding in wagons upon feather mattresses, whilst we slodge along behind, don't we? Maybe they are alive, Matty. Aye, and from some place very far away as well, Matty. Accounts for why they all look like brass and glass and all. Boys, now don't be telling me such things. Do you swear? Nodding solemnly. Far, far away, Matt. Distant and strange. New Jersey? They do need tender handling, boys, young Nathaniel McLean tries sternly to advise the 5-shilling hands. Like your mother's pussy, is the reply. My mother, counters the young swamper equably, say, just saw your mother going out to shoot. Somebody stepped on her infantry boots. I saw your mother, and I quiz you not, drinking penny gin from a chamber pot. Ladies, please, there are gentlemen present, announces overseer of the axemen, Moses Barnes. Is everybody round here named Moses? 7 and 6 per week, approaching with a heaviness of step often felt minutes before his actual appearance. Hark, is it poetry? Dear me, Cedric, where have I put my quill? Those anxious to be his friends greet this with prolonged mirth. Barnes is a large enforcer of rules, with beefy, undiluted eyes and a reluctance to be far from the cook tent. Having long intimidated commissaries into serving him gigantic piles of food, he has achieved a mast which would shame a military wagon. Implicit in most of his dealings with the Axemen is the threat that should they fail to comply closely enough with his wishes, this enormous yet mobile weight may in some way unspoken, and, 'tis further implied, unspeakable, be directed against them. Takes them less than a week to run the line through somebody's house. About a mile and a half west of the 12-mile arc, 24 chains beyond Little Christiana Creek, on Wednesday, April 10th, the field book reports, at 3 miles, 49 chains went through Mr. Price's house. Just took a wild guess, Mrs. Price, quite amiable, where we'd build it. Not as if my husband's a surveyor or anything. Which side's to be Pennsylvania, by the way? A mischievous glint in her eyes that Barnes, Farlow, Moses McLean, and others will later all recall. Mr. Price is in town in search of partners for a land venture. Would you gentlemen mind coming in the house and showing me just where your line does run? Mason and Dixon, already feeling awkward about it, oblige. Dixon up on the roof with a long plumb line, Mason a squint at the snout of the instrument. Mrs. Price, meantime, fills her table with plates of sour cherry fritters, neat's tongue pies, a gigantic Indian pudding, pitchers aslosh with homemade cider, then producing some new hackled streaks of hemp, and laying them down in a right line according to the surveyor's advice, fixing them here and there with tacks, across the room, up the stairs, straight down the middle of the bed, of course, which is about when Mr. Reese Price happens to return from his business in town to find Mary Axemen lounging beneath his sassafras tree, strange stock mingling with his own and watering out of his branch, his house invaded by surveyors, and his wife giving away the larder and waving her tankard about crying, "Husband, what province were we married in?" Ah, see him gape, for he cannot remember. "'Twas in Pennsylvania, my tortoise, but never in Maryland, hey?" So, from now on, when I am upon this side of the house, I am in Maryland, legally not your wife, and no longer subject to your authority. Isn't that right, gents? "Ask the Reverend," they reply together, perhaps having noticed that Mr. Price is carrying a long Pennsylvania rifle, 2 horns full of powder, and a good supply of balls. Eh? The Reverend, by all signs unaware of the trouble the gentlemen are putting him to, not to mention in, beams at the so far but perplexed back inhabitant. "I know but how to perform the ceremony. Perhaps you need to consult an attorney at law." Separating neighbors is one thing, Reese Price declares, but separating husband and wife, no wonder you people get shot at all the time. No wonder those chains are called the devil's guts. He must struggle to work himself up into a rage, owing to an insufficient exposure, so far, to evil and sorrow, remaining a youth who trusts all he may meet to be as kindly disposed as he. What'll happen is, Alex McLean advises, is you'll get hammered paying double taxes, visits all the time from sheriffs of both provinces looking for their quit rents, tax collectors from Philadelphia and Annapolis, and sooner or later you'll have to decide just to get it up on some logs and roll it one way or the other. Depends how your property runs, I'd guess. As north is pretty much uphill, Mr. Price is reckoning, 'twould certainly not be as easy to roll her up into Pennsylvania as down into Maryland. "Where I am no longer your wife," she reminds him. "Aye, and there's another reason," he nods soberly. "Well then, let's fetch the boys and get to it. 'Tis Maryland ho." Chapter 45. Back inhabitants all up and down the line soon begin taking the Frenchman's duck to their bosoms, for being exactly what they wish to visit their lives at this moment. Something possessed of extra-natural powers, invisibility, inexhaustible strength, an upper velocity range that makes her the match in momentum of much larger opponents, Americans desiring generally that every fight be fair. Soon tales of duck exploits are everywhere the line may pass. The duck routs a great army of Indians. The duck levels a mountain west of here. In a single afternoon, the duck, with her beak, has plowed every field in the county, at the same time harrowing with her tail. That duck! As to the duck's actual presence, opinions among the party continue to vary. Axemen, for whom tales of disaster, stupidity, and blind luck figure repeatedly as occasions for merriment, take to shouting at their companions, "There she goes," or "Nearly fetched ye one," whilst those more susceptible to the shifts of breeze between the worlds, notably at twilight, claim to have seen the actual duck shimmering into visibility for a few moments, then out again. I might have tried to draw a bead onto it, but it knew I was there. It came walking over and looked me thump in the eye. I was down flat. We were at the same level, see? Where am I? It wants to know. Pennsylvania or Maryland, take your pick, says I. It had this kind of expression onto its face and seemed jumpy. I tried to calm it down. It gave that hum and grew vaporous and disappeared. Mason and Dixon attempt to ignore as much of this as they may, both assuming 'tis only another episode of group folly to which this project seems particularly given, and that 'twill pass all too soon to be replaced by another, and so on, till perhaps one day by something truly dangerous. They'll believe what they like, groans Mason, in this age with its faith in a mechanical ingenuity whose ways will be forever dark to them. God help this mobility. They have to take all projectors upon trust, half of whom have nothing to sell, who know none the less of this irrational need to believe in automatons, believe that they can sing and dance and play chess, even at the end of the turn when the latch is pressed and the midget revealed and the indomitable hands fall still. Even as Monsieur Vaucanson furls back the last silk vestment, no matter. The axemen have a need for artificial life as perverse as any among the Parisian au monde, and this French toy, conveniently invisible, seems to... Look out! Dixon cries. Mason's hat leaves his head and ascends straight up to the treetops, where it pauses, catching the rays of the sun just gone behind tomorrow's ridgetop. Faint quacking is heard above. Very well, Mason calls. Toy may have been insensitive. I apologize. Device? Armand comes running out. His being playful, nothing more. Ah, chérie, he sings into the sky. I'll guarantee their behavior, only please return the gentleman's hat. Merci. As the hat comes down, leafwise, zigging one way, zagging another, whilst Mason runs back and forth anxiously beneath. You'll guarantee what? Dixon wants to know. Whilst advanced in some areas, such as flight and invisibility, Armand explains, yet in others does the duck remain primitive, foremost in her readiness to take offense. You must have noticed she has no shame. Any pretext at all will do. As her metaphysical powers increase, so do her worldly resentments, real and imagined, the shape of her destiny pulled earthward and rising heavenward at the same time. Meanwhile, gaining an order of magnitude in passing from the personal to the continental, if not the planetary. Perhaps fortunately, no one present has any idea what he is talking about. I should have puzzled more, Mason now admits, that Dr. Vaucanson was listed among those sent copies of Monsieur Delisle's map monde for the transit of Venus, showing us the preferred locations for observing the event. Arrived at the Royal Society in the care of Father Boscovich years late, owing to the state of the rivalry. I assumed, as everyone did, that the great automateur, having an interest in the celestial escapement above, and the date of the event, being sure as clockwork, had early announced his intention to observe the impending alignment, or even more simply, that he enjoyed esteem at the Académie. But between the invention of the duck and the observation of the transit, there lies yet a logical chasm, as a temporal one, 30 years or more in width, with no bridge of syllogism for reasons to cross, condemned rather to roam upstream and down in search of a way, her journey delayed indefinitely upon the nearer side. The side of the duck, Armand reminds him. Very well, could it be that in the years since the duck vanished, and despite the constant presence of the duplicate the world knows, Monsieur Vaucanson, in his perusals of the sky, has come to seek there wonders more than merely astronomical? Or having no idea of where or how far his creature's morphosis may have taken it, where look for word of its condition with more hope of success than among the incorruptibly divided rings of heaven? Hold, hold, Dixon with exaggerated gentleness. Mason, he believes his duck to have become a planet? Is that what they're saying? Why are you all edging away from me like that? Mason's voice pitched distraughtly. For a few moments among the centuries, we are allowed to observe her own morphosis, from numinary to solid spheroid. I don't know about you, but if I had a duck disappear from me that way, I should certainly be attending closely the categories of rapid change, such as the transit afforded, for evidence of the creature's passage. Even without the full face of discomfort Mason displays, Dixon would have understood this as yet another gawkish expression of grieving for his wife. Someone's wrecking the squash, I think. Armand backing into the cook tent, colliding with young Hickman, emerging with a stack of pots and pans, headed for the scullery, which all promptly go scattering in every direction, more than once passing but inches from people's heads. Nothing personal, both nearly in unison, assure Mason. Such is the duck's influence in the camp that several axemen approach the Reverend upon the topic of angels in general. For instance, Carol's young Nath McLean, lately Daisy for a milkmaid of the vicinity, though we know the duck has been transformed by love, what of the angels? That is, may they, Aye, they do that, lad, and they drink and smoke and dance and gamble withal. Thought everyone knew that. Some might even define an angel as a being who's powerful enough not to be destroyed by desire in all its true and terrible dimensions. Why, a drop of their porter? 'Twould kill the hardiest drinker among ye. They smoke substances whose most distant scent would asphyxiate us. Their dancing floors extend for leagues. Their wagering, upon even a single trivial matter, would beggar Clive of India. And who's to say that human sin, down here, may not arise from this very inadequacy of ours, this failure of scale before the sovereign commands of desire? Sin, as practiced, is not deep enough for you, sir? Inquires Dixon. Why is it that we honor the great thieves of Whitehall for acts that in Whitechapel would merit hanging? Why admire the one sort of thief and despise the other? I suggest 'tis because of the scale of the crime. What we of the mobility love to watch is any of the great matrices, greed, lust, revenge, taken out of all measure, brought quite past the scale of the everyday world, approaching what we always knew were the true dimensions of desire. Let Antony lose the world for Cleopatra, to be sure, not Dick his day's wages at the tavern. Chapter 46. When they may, they drink. So does everyone else. Presently, as they come more and more under the jurisdiction of the night sky, they drink less after dark, finding it impossible to look out into that, however narrowed the field, with vision in any way a wobble, and be expected to work the micrometer, take readings, note the time, and perform 100 other tasks, most of them unforgivingly in need of accuracy. Cloudy nights, of course, being exceptions to this rule, are welcomed by all. Each 10 minutes of the great circle, about every 12 miles, their intention is to pause, set up the sector and determine their latitude, then figure the offsets to the true line over the distance they've just come. The true line that has run along with them at their left hands, an invisible companion, but yards away in the brush, outside the firelight. 12 miles from the post marked west, the party crosses the road from Octorara to Christiana Bridge, with a farmhouse close by, upon the Pennsylvania side. Here they set up camp and begin their latitude work. Axemen set off in search of food. The fragrant noontide so quiet you may hear the shuffling of playing cards. 'Tis a Saturday, in that lull when all the sellers have passed early into town, and most of the buyers and families who dwell within a few hours by wagon have not yet begun to head back home. Now and then, horsemen dismount at the tavern a few chains up the road, as others come reeling back from it, sometimes deciding to sleep overnight here in camp. After half a dozen such have dropped into midday slumber, do we encourage this? Mason asks himself aloud in Dixon's hearing. Suppose but one of them is a French agent, pretending to be drunk, perhaps even bent upon our dissolution. As Christians, have we any choice but to allow all who wish to enter freely? Offers Dixon. Well, as you put it that way. The crew, now up to 30 hands, having in their first 10 minutes of arc crossed 3 creeks and a river and gone through 1 house, are disposed to a merry weekend, though mornings when the demands of recompense fall heaviest are not to be altogether restful, so near as Octorara Road. Wagons full of iron products, bar and rod stock, nails, hatchets, and knives, drawn by teams of oxen, pass slowly, a clank and a creak, each step a drama, left to right, right to left, across the visto all the day. When night falls, the drivers unhitch and outspan their teams and make fires and stay up drinking well past the culminations of the later stars. For Mason and Dixon, attending the clock, the plumb line, the eternal heavens, can hear them in dispute, often upon some point of religion. "Unco quantity of iron upon the road," comments Dixon. "'Tis running me old needle amuck." "Aye, as if the Prussian army's about some place." Mason none too pleased with any of it. First thing Monday morning, they all come staggering from bedrolls and latrines to stand in loose ranks and be tallied in. Overseer Barnes reads the plan of the day. The Reverend comes by to say a short prayer. Then special requests are submitted. A few in writing, but most allowed and expected to be dealt with upon the spot. Some mornings the petitioning grows agitated indeed, with only the clanging of the breakfast alarm able to interrupt it. "He's telling them parrot jokes again." "Who is?" "You know, him." "Ehud, is this true, what he's saying?" "Mr. Barnes, Captain, sir, all I said was, sailor walks into a tavern with a parrot on his shoulder. Young lass says, 'There, he's doing it again.' 'What'll it be?' And the parrot says, 2 hours extra duty, Ehud.' 'Yes, Mr. Spinney.' 'Is the porridge again, Captain? As previously sworn, I can't abide an oat milled that way, and they all know it in the commissary. Yet each morning, looking up at me from the bowl, faugh, one more deliberate insult. The cook's all snickering. How long before I must begin to vomit, I'd like to know. Then you must grind your own, lad, as the Indians do, between stones. There's boiling water in the cook tent. Ask politely, and they may let you have some of that. Thank ye, Captain, as ever. Yet there abides the question of the salt. I'll have a word with them, Spinney. Now, is it too much or too little salt, exactly? On second thought, never mind, Captain. You're sure now, 'tis no trouble. Wonderful. And now whom do I see but I, Mr. Sweet, back again, are we? How repetitious. Let me divine what your request may be. My mate, he was a Philadelphia lawyer once, but gave it all up for the freedom of the forest, he says that as an expedition overland is like a ship at sea, Mr. Mason may, like a ship's captain, exercise certain prerogatives. Ah, Mr. Barnes, raising a huge hand. And a lovelier lass was never seen this side of the previous cowshed, I'm sure. Yet, how long can this go on, boy? Were you a woman, I'd say you were but flighty, and there'd be an end. But in a lad, you know, it makes me apprehensive. Suppose you do marry one of them. What happens when you meet the next? Wait, let me ask my mate. Chat with thee tomorrow, sir. Lovely, and remember me to your betrothed, and your mate, of course. Next. Mr. McNutley, it's been near a year, man. Not another one in the works. All the best, and you're such a scraggy ancient, too. My thinking, Captain, though some say hop to it just after the harvest, so they'll give birth and be up again in time for next harvest, but I say just before planting's better, so they can help with that, yet not be so far along by harvest that they can't help considerable with that, too. Albeit, my Gwen, she's due in a month or two, I think, and I ought to be with her pretty soon. Grow tits, Mr. Barnes advises, and learn to talk for an hour without taking a breath. And maybe, as she grows more dazed with her pregnancy, she'll mistake ye for another woman, taking from it what comfort she may. Otherwise, 'tis the company of women she needs, not the author of it all thumping about. On they come. Still too ill-assorted, too newly hired to know what they may profitably expect and what will ever remain hopeless, though some will develop a taste for the exquisite discomforts of rejection. Here is a protest, not the first, about Mrs. Eggslap's troublesome habit of extorting a higher fee once her services are in progress. This time to Stig, the Swedish axeman. He speaks no English, Mr. Barnes no Swedish, yet all have heard the dismal story before. At least once in every sentence, Stig cries, "Yingle yangle, yingle yangle," denoting something of importance to him. Here is young Mr. McLean. He's just the one you ought to see, Stig. "Ya, ya, yust the vun." Nathaniel, the youngest of the Macleans, is here working during his summer vacation from college in Williamsburg. At first, the crew accorded him the drone of intimate insult, which is ever the tenderfoot's lot, up to a point, at least, for his father and brothers are here, well in control of all aspects of the expedition, from turning angles to peeling potatoes. Soon, how none can say, the axemen have assigned to Nathaniel a character closer to Macheath than to the diligent factotum he knows himself to be, though he's tried to explain what in this party he is and isn't. Yet do they expect him to take bribes, to wink at gambling, to keep local justices of the peace and sheriffs satisfied? Above all, they continue to regard him as the bully who protects Mrs. Eggslap and all her fair colleagues, who some days have numbered in the dozens. Hence Mr. Barnes' patent relief at Nath's appearance now. He only looks like a kid, but he's dangerous, too dangerous for me. This from Moses Barnes, generally a judge too dangerous for everybody else. Hello, Mr. Maclean. Quite another scorcher today, isn't it? Hope everything's to your satisfaction. Oh, come on then, Nath says. I'm on my way to see Mo anyhow. They proceed to the mess tent, where Moses Maclean is sitting in front of and frowning at a pile of accounts. As he is employed here, but upon trial, Moses supposes, his expenses may legitimately be withheld from the books. And thus are they able to pacify Stig with a sum whose immediacy outdazzles its modesty. Yet Nath is not quite free of the matter, for Mrs. Eggslap accosts him in the muddy shade behind the cook tent. I do wish you wouldn't keep saying extortion, she pleads more than once. Nath makes the mistake of asking her then, what does she think it is? I knew we'd reach an understanding, grasping his hand and placing it upon her hip as if they were about to dance. That's Stig, Nath blurts. You know he doesn't even speak English, Mrs. E. You took unfair advantage. Nathaniel, my hasty puddin', he brings that axe to bed. He talks to it and wants me to do the same. Oh, how do you do there, says I to it, as so would you were it being wiggled at you by some piece of logging machinery with an erection. Then he starts in with the yingle-yangle, right? Yingle-yangle. I know that accent well. 'Tis from the neighborhood of Bedlam. Is that blushing, Nath, or but the sun in that innocent face? Have ye never heard of bonus pay for hazardous duty? That's what I was adding on. 50%, he's heedless enough to remind her. For you, my turtle dove, I'd cap it at, oh, let's say half of that, 25. It's still exorbitant. 5 of it to you, of course. 5%? Oh, all right, 10. I never could resist a sweet face. She swiftly kisses him, pressing into his hand some sort of banknote, and is off in a wake of jasmine absolute. As if waiting upon an invisible cue, up next pops the Passbank bully guy Spit, with another offer of a share in the Passbank proceeds. He is now offering 15%, up from 12. He believes Nath to be a hard bargainer, holding out for more, when in fact the youth is but trying to avoid an entire new mountain range of worry in the terrain already given him to toil up and down in. But it throws all Mr. Spitz's calculations out. Indeed, he assures Nath, 'twould threaten the very arrangement were he to refuse some share. For all the warnings Nath has received as to avoiding temptation, he'd not seen the true article at first hand till the swamper's post fell to him by virtue of his family's favor with Mason and Dixon. 'Twill be his salvation, Archibald Maclean assured the astronomers. He is wasting too damned much time reading books. He lives in some world all of us would be lucky to inhabit, but do not. And so neither must he? Mr. Dixon, pretending astonishment. Why, heavens, books aren't going to hurt him. Once he's found out about them, 'tis too late in any case. One way or another, he'll read what he needs to. Mr. Maclean, stung, cocks his head. How many sons have you, sir? Eh, friend, I have but been one. How be it, then? Mr. Maclean shrugs and seeks Dixon's gaze. Mostly that we'll need the extra hand? Thus, soon to his father's unconcern, Nath is as wildly aspin in unsuspected engagement with established greed as any nabobescent young writer out in Bengal. Book reading is no match, though he tries, being loaned the choicest of limp, creased, and spattered books of erotic pictures and text, staying up to finish an extra chapter in the ghastly fop to see how it comes out, having at last no time to read nor even look at etchings. By the time he remembers how to unbutton his breeches, he has fallen asleep. He is now falling asleep, usually face first, with no warning, into not only his own bowl of soup, but great kettles of it as well. And not only soup, but porridge, too. He also falls out of trees, off stools, and into card games, scattering the hands and coins and usually getting thumped for it. For days on end, pressed by continual demands, he may eat nothing but a fugitive crust, sauced with the lees of some ale jack and the pipe ash therein. Yet suddenly, as in a spring flood, will he find himself devouring without pause, through the workday, anything that comes to hand or even too close. Mr. Barnes says he has seen Nath eating in his sleep, though this may be but more of the overseer's great wit. "Ahoy, Murray," Nath writes to his school friend back in Tidewater, Virginia. "Was there a sermon about greed? Did I sleep through it? Nothing has prepared me for its power, how unabating, its fertility, how wild, occasion for it being presented with every tally mark, bottle astray, honest favor, milkmaid's douceur, diversion of tobacco, exchange of specie. Every numeral uttered, be it upon paper or spoken low and allowed to pass with the next breath into the forgotten. They will forever do me favors I do not need. Strings of iridescent trout, July cherries by the bushel, with the stones already out, land transaction advice that would put me in a mansion upon Rappahannock with hundreds of slaves, and no worries forever." That is, rewarded as panderers are, in every form but cash, a scarce enough commodity at the coast, becoming, further west, at last only another fabled American substance. "What's happening to me, Murray? This sordid haggling out in the open air, axemen sidling by with knowing grins, girls peering apprehensively round corners, popping up from bushes to blow me kisses of encouragement, even Mr. Mason with his eyebrows up into his hat, and Mr. Dixon whistling airs from The Beggar's Opera. I am not the sinister pimp they take me for. Oh, for someone understanding out here in this endless forest. We could ride our winged pigs side by side through the ether and chat about it all." Sweet face. Of course, that's it, without a doubt. They talk to me in high, sing-song voices. Either I look younger than I am, or people assume I am some kind of idiot. Is this what books call wheedling? I have heard my first wheedling, like discovering a new species of bird. 'Tis this curse of being a grown youth, well clapped to life's harness, yet looking as I did at 3. Men don't trust it. More women than I ever imagined find it desirable. I am obliged to behave as unnaturally male toward the one sex as cherubically neutral toward the other. How is it I nonetheless covet every fair creature who happens, day by day, to appear in the path of this line? As it speeds its way like a coach upon the coaching road of desire, where we create continually before us the road we must journey upon, the axeman as diligent and unobtrusive as the tailor of Gloucester's mice. Chapter 47. The instrument carriers wait till Monday to go back to Mr. Bryant's and pick up the sector. "Not so bad so far, do you think?" Robert Farlow, who was driving the empty wagon, remarked to Thomas Hickman beside him. "Not bad for fields we've all worked in forever." Hickman, who is receiving a shilling more than Farlow this week, bears a worried look. The other 6-shilling man, Matt Marine, took himself off up the bridge road sometime in the dark and hasn't been seen since, leaving it upon Hickman's shoulders to make sure no harm comes to the sector. Behind them, back in the dust and wood smoke, the ringing of axe bits diminishes with distance. John Harland and John Hannings and Kit Myers recline in the wagon bed among the cushions for the sector, the ragged breeze of their progress bringing them the pleasing scents of the spring tide as they roll along the Newcastle Road, 2 to 3 miles south of the line and roughly parallel to it. Overhead, birds carry twigs to secret destinations. Beside the road, children come running to stare, caps askew, forks and churns left to lie. Farmers in wagons coming the other way wave, or sometimes, knowing who they are, glare. Each time they set out slightly to the north of west upon a bearing that will describe 10 minutes of great circle before intersecting again the true west line. The gentlemen know from calculation that the angle to be turned off must be 0 degrees, 8 minutes, 18 seconds to the northward of perfect west. For a while they take sky observations to confirm this, Dixon as if in deference to Mason as astronomer. But presently they are turning the angle directly from the plate of the instrument, a surveyor's habit that Dixon may feel more comfortable with, which they drift wordlessly into, beginning to learn, each at his own rate, that the choice not to dispute oftentimes sets free minutes, indeed hours, otherwise wasted in issueless quarreling. Neither appreciates this at the time. When they reach the end of each 12-mile or so segment, they stop and set up the sector to find the distances, in degrees, of several stars at their highest points in the night from the zenith. Bradley's star catalog gives the declination or celestial latitude for each star. This value, plus the zenith distance, equals the earthly latitude of the observing point. Owing to the error in taking bearings that ever accompanies the running of a real arc upon the not quite perfectly spherical Earth, the sector will never be set up exactly in the latitude of the true line. So offsets are figured at each mile, ranging from zero at the eastern end to whatever the difference in latitude might prove to be at the other. These offsets must then be added to the purely geometrical differences at each mile between the 10 minutes of great circle actually run and its chord, the line itself, each time increasing from zero to about 21 feet at the halfway point, then decreasing again to zero. As Fortune had put their first 10 minutes of arc close to the Octorara Road, so does their next stage west allow them to set up the sector but 26 chains short of the east bank of Susquehanna, a mile and a half of taverns strung near and nearer along the way up to the Peach Bottom Ferry. On Sunday, the 12th of May, they begin their zenith obs again, continuing them till the 29th. It will be a brisk and pleasant fortnight beside the broad river, which dashes and rolls round two small islands directly in the line of the Visto. On days of cloud, they endeavor to project the line across the river, whose breadth they take the occasion to compute, though the task falls mostly to Dixon, being, as Mason informs everyone, more surveyor's work, really. Dixon and Mr. McLean, along with Darby and Cope, go trudging down to the river to have a look. Common practice would be to measure out a baseline upon the further bank, set up there, turn off 90 degrees, put a mark on the near side, come back across, set up at the mark there, and find the angle between the two ends of the baseline. Then, with the aid of a book full of logarithms, including those of trig functions, 'twould take but a minute and a half of adding and checking to find the distance across the river. That's how we learned in Durham, Dixon recalls, to measure across places we'd rather not go. Not so much rivers, of course, as unexpected patches, sudden entire ranges of spoil heaps, or a grove out in an empty fell. Certainly nowhere near this damned many trees. I've found little joy in these situations, offers Mr. McLean, whilst Darby and Cope nod at one another, silent as understudies in the wings, moving their lips no more than necessary. Sweating and muttering, all go tramping up and down the bank, kicking up clouds of gnats, crushing wild herbs and blossom, seeking a line of sight that will allow them to use a right angle, a fool's errand, as it proves. At length, we'll have to use what angles we can, then, that bonny with everyone? And more than soon enough for the chain men, though Mr. McLean is shaking his head. I never get the figures right. Then let us prevail somehow upon Mr. Mason to review our computing, angles being the same, so I surmise, down here as out there. Mr. McLean takes over the 18-inch Hadleys, and Dixon repeats his sights with the circumferenter, obtaining at last an ungainly oblique triangle from which they calculate Susquehanna to be about 7/8 of a mile across. To Mason, meanwhile, has fallen the task of projecting the line across the river and setting upon its western bank a point they might take up again from. Upon their last Saturday at Susquehanna, he writes, "About sunset, I was returning from the other side of the river, and at the distance of about 1.5 miles, the lightning fell in perpendicular streaks, about a foot in breadth to appearance, from the cloud to the ground. This was the first lightning I ever saw in streaks continued without the least break through the hole, all the way from the cloud to the horizon." Less formally, he comes running screaming into Dixon's tent just as Dixon is lighting his evening pipe. "Did you see that?" "Bright as day," Dixon nods. "Lord, into what suburb satanic hast thou introduced me this time? Thy procedure's not to be questioned, of course." The wind has begun to shake the tents. The surveyors hear the stumbling of raindrops against the taut duck. Their candle flames are being torn to shining waxen wild flowers. "I am assuming that I may be confident of my safety here," Dixon puffing, "the entire issue of lightning in America having been resolved by your friend Dr. Franklin, who draws it off at will, easy as drawing ale from a cask." "I have got that correct, haven't I? 'Tis certainly the right place for lightning, eh? Nothing like this in Staindrop. Lud Ofrey did claim to have been hit once over by Low Dinsdale, but there were no other witnesses." "Dixon, our lives are in danger?" Hardly enough to interrupt a perfectly good. Here he is silenced by an immense thunderbolt from directly overhead, as their frail prism is bleached in unholy light. "Saturday night, for, is it, I ask you?" His head emerging at last from beneath a blanket. "Mason, say, Mason, are the..." Mason, now outside, pushes aside the tent flap with his head, but does not enter. "Dixon, I will now seek shelter beneath that wagon out there. Do you see it? If you wish to join me, there's room." "Bit too much iron there for me, thanks all the same." "Interesting. Up to you, of course." Another great blinding peal. When Dixon can see again, Mason has withdrawn. Each lightning stroke, another step across the landscape, the miles-high electrical insect, whose footfalls are thunderclaps, proceeds at some broken, incomprehensible pace, passing on toward Philadelphia and the sea, and the sky is restored to its pitiless clarity in time to obtain a good zenith distance for Capella. Their latest orders, galloped in by express, are to return to the tangent point and run the 3.5 miles of meridian or north line needed to close the boundaries of the lower counties. A line must now be drawn northward from the tangent point till striking the west line at right angles, thus defining the northeast corner of Maryland. To obtain this last 5 miles of boundary, the parties have agreed, as if repenting close to the end of a long life of error, to draw the line at last due north and south. Esteemed Murray, whatever else happens upon this expedition, I am getting to meet an uncommon lot of milkmaids. Every morning and evening they line up among the tents in the canvas alleyways, clanking pails and kettles and whispering among themselves, and laughing. Ah, laughter at the outset of the day. Some are lovely beyond the pen of this wretched apprentice. Some, but even apprentice must refrain from comparison. Gladly would I welcome attention from any of them. Alas, what am I to do? Whilst, for their own part, the lasses, often quite brazen about it, go on thinning the milk with well water, putting in snails to make it froth, keeping it warm who knows how. Coy milkmaids being a game courtly as any back in the metropolis, and, like dancing, exercised with ease and enjoyment upon both sides. His cream-pot love in the morning dew, again at the close of day, one creeps about like a spider who might covet some curds and whey. For 'tis, "Dairy, oh, gimme that dairy, the lengths that I'd go to for its sake are extraordinary." The step, you see, like this, and, "I see a cow and just drool, act like a fool, any time a cheese roll by. Butter and milk, foods of that ilk, make me shake my head, going me, oh my. Polly's in the penthouse, Molly's in the mood, everybody's looking for that lactic food. Oh, dairy, though seasons may vary, I'll ever be very enchanted by you." In the midst of teaching a long queue of fair purveyors the steps of a real current at Williamsburg, young Nath is abruptly smit. Miracle! After miserable nights in roadside hovels, styled inns, the companionless sunsets turn after planets turn, the days of regarding daughters and even wives of settlers with what I once imagined a soulful gaze, not always distinguishable by she that received it from an offensive stare, unexpectedly to find in the day's first dew, with the light increasing so swiftly, apt any instant to reveal in her that decisive flaw the crepuscule had hidden, though steadfast beneath the light, she but grew more fair. Her, whom I call Galactica, for she is one of the purveyors to this expedition of dairy products. Oh, I can hear you, another tale of cream-pot love. Well, I, of course, as one who has not practiced it in this Edenic dairyland, though Galactica be in that larcenous sisterhood, not truly of it, what I'm in is a sailor's predicament. Far too soon must we extend the line past any journey she can make in safety, or indeed find the time for. There is no question of her joining our caravan. Her duty here is as compelling as would be my own were she to come to deflect from her person the attentions of up to 100 men, including the implacable Stig. So must I beseech her wait till winter, when we leave off and return eastward, then until we head west again in the spring, and so on. Moments too few, and the waiting too heavy a burden, I fear, upon fair Galactica. For though I know next to nothing about the sex, yet it seems, in my experience, that their reputation for patience is gravely overblown, and the faithful sailor sweetheart of song and romance as mythical as a mermaid. Chapter 48. On the 29th of May, they turn eastward again, measuring offsets and marking them as they go. Now they begin the day sighting into the sun and watching their own shadows at evening, surveyor and tripod and instrument stretching back somehow toward the past, toward more youthful selves. Going west, even no further than Susquehanna, living by the simple diurnal rhythms, going ever with the sun was not the same as this going against it. "Aye, very different indeed," remarks Dixon. Mason is trying to wake up. The nearest coffee is in the cook tent. "Pray you," he whispers, "try not to be so damned." Did I say damned? I meant so fucking chirpy all the time. Good chap, good chap, stumbling out of the tent, trying to get his hair into some kind of queue. The coffee is brewed with the aid of a Fahrenheit thermometer, unmarked save at one place, exactly halfway between freezing and boiling, at 122 degrees, where, upon the wood, a small arrow is inscribed, pointing at a scratch across the glass tube. 'Tis at this temperature that the water receives the ground coffee, the brew being stirred once or twice, the pot removed from the fire, its decoction then proceeding. Though clarifying may make sense in London, out here 'tis a luxury, nor are there always eggshells to hand.